To stop the coronavirus, the Chinese government has taken some extreme measures like mass quarantine, but it doesn't seem to be working. I'm Arun Vanagopal, and today on The Takeaway for February 11th, we'll speak to two journalists who experienced these quarantines firsthand. Also on the show, the National Archives have moved forward with a plan that would allow ICE to destroy or delete documents that show the death or sexual abuse of undocumented immigrants in their custody.
Many detainees have been denied decent medical care, leading to, in many cases, illness or worse, leading to death. And these records surprised me, but in many cases, these were the kinds of records that they decided could be deleted.
Plus, we were joined by Kathy Yan to discuss her latest film, Birds of Prey.
It could be more than just like a bleak version of the future or a dystopian version of what we're used to. And I think especially given where we are right now, a nice dose of hope and humor is always welcome.
Plenty of news for you, so let's get to it. Across the globe, the spread of coronavirus shows no signs of slowing down. This week, Chinese health officials reported that more than 40,000 people have been infected globally. The death toll is also on the rise, with more than 1,000 reported deaths so far. The majority of those cases are in China, where everyday life is at a standstill. In an effort to contain the coronavirus, Chinese authorities have implemented mass quarantines across central China, specifically around the city of Wuhan and the Hubei province, where the virus first broke out. A government-imposed lockdown in the region has restricted transportation, and people are being encouraged to remain in their homes. Plus, many businesses and schools are still closed across China. But despite the quarantine, the number of confirmed infections continues to climb daily. At the same time, a different kind of quarantine is taking place online. The Chinese government has been working to suppress discussion of the outbreak since late December, when people first started posting about it across the internet. For more on this, we're joined by two journalists who've recently been quarantined. Stephen McDonald, Beijing-based correspondent with the BBC, and Sean Lee, China-based correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks to you both for coming back on the program.
Hi, Arun.
Good to talk to you.
Now, both of you have personally been under quarantine during this outbreak. Sean, let's start with you. How did you get out of quarantine?
So I was in quarantine in China in Hubei province for 12 days. And essentially, the local authorities told us that the quarantine was going to be extended indefinitely. And the only way out of the city where we were and out of Hubei province was to take the American evacuation flight out of Wuhan. So that's what we did with me and a colleague last Friday. So now I'm in quarantine again in the U.S. at Travis Air Force Base for another 14 days in Northern California.
And how do the conditions compare from China to where you are right now?
It's very different. So in China, we weren't allowed to leave our rooms because at a certain point, they were afraid that we were actually infected, even though our temperatures were normal. So in the U.S., we're allowed to leave our rooms. You know, we're allowed to go outside on the hotel grounds. We're on the airbase in a hotel, and but they put up temporary barricades around the hotel grounds, guarded by U.S. marshals in case we go stir crazy and make a run for it. Mm-hmm. But there's a striking difference between the two.
And did you feel stir crazy at any points during this last few weeks?
In China, definitely, because we were confined to our rooms and we were there for over a week. So even though it was a very nice hotel, you kind of get sensory deprivation for not having seen or spoken to anyone else for over a week.
Stephen, you were just released from quarantine in Beijing, correct? How was your experience different?
So what happened to us is we went into Hubei province from Hunan. That's a neighboring province. We wanted to go in that way because we knew that these sort of lockdowns were starting. And we thought if we have a car that's got Hubei plates, it's going to restrict us. So we went to Hunan, hired a car and drove in. Now, on the way in, apart from going past, the more and more serious roadblocks as you approach Hubei, we went in sort of via a back street. I think we thought it would be pretty easy to go down this dirt road and sneak into this province. But even there was a police roadblock and they were like, oh, well, you can go in, but we're not going to let you back out again. And at this point, we realized they were going to lock down all of Hubei. This is 60 million people, effectively, you're locking down the entire population of Italy. And, we nevertheless pressed on and drove through various ghost town-like places with nobody on the streets and some small cities there. And we ended up at one place where we're at a hospital, and interviewing a patient on the inside via a phone app who told us he was pretty worried because he'd gone into the hospital. He had a temperature, but he thought he didn't necessarily have the coronavirus when he went in, but he thought he might catch it anyway because they'd stuck him in this ward with other coronavirus patients. And so he sort of inevitably thought he is going to end up being infected. Anyway, at this point, the police turn up and some local government officials, and they didn't want us to be there in their town and reporting. They sort of wanted us to move on, and we're saying, well, look, you know, really, we wanted to go back to Hunan at some point, but you know, we can't go back there now. It's locked down. And at this point, they decided, well, they'd rather breach their own quarantine rules than have a team of pesky journalists hanging around there. And so we had a police escort, lights flashing and everything, and they drove us back across out of Hubei, and that's how we got out of that province and ended up returning to Beijing. Now, anybody who's been in Hubei is advised to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. So we just decided to do it anyway. Like my boss said, you know, stay at home for 2 weeks. But it's funny, the response to this in all aspects of this emergency, it differs from city to city. So two of my colleagues went back to Shanghai. Now in Shanghai, they've been much more strict on journalists there. They had police and medical teams knocking on the door, making them sign documents. You will not leave your home for 2 weeks, etc. In Beijing, it hasn't been like that. I just got a call from the foreign ministry. Oh, I heard you've been there. Are you sick? You're staying at home? Okay, look after yourself. See you later. So it just depends where you end up in terms of how strict it is.
Sean, the Wall Street Journal, your paper, had a headline stating that President Xi inspected a hospital after, quote, a conspicuous absence. Has his absence had political reverberations?
Yes. I mean, he hasn't been seen publicly at any sort of hospital or talking to patients. He actually dispatched the premier to Wuhan a few weeks ago to visit hospitals and speak to infected patients and medical workers. So it's the fact that he hasn't shown his face in the front lines of the outbreak has been very conspicuous, especially as public anger has surged over the weeks with how the government has been handling it. And last week, when that young doctor in Wuhan, the whistleblower doctor, Li Wenliang, died from after being infected with coronavirus, there was just a huge outpouring online of people questioning where was the government, how were they handling or mishandling the outbreak.
And so how has the government responded to this anger?
So they have aggressively censored a lot of people's comments online. The censors have been working overtime. And on the other hand, they've also been sending more higher level health experts to Hubei and to Wuhan. So just yesterday, Hubei province ousted two top level provincial health officials and actually replaced them with a veteran health official from the National Health Commission. So it appears like they're bringing in more experts also. The team from the WHO landed in China yesterday to help the government's response. So those are sort of two aspects of what they're doing.
Stephen, the BBC has a graph showing that cases are beginning to drop in China based on data from the China National Health Commission. How significant is this information?
Well, let's assume for the moment that at least in trend terms, that these official figures mean something. And they've been heavily criticized, the figures, for not catching all the cases. And even the government knows they're not going to catch all the cases. Of course they're not. But okay, let's say that at least in trend terms, they show a pattern. Over the last week, especially outside of Hubei province, the numbers are not growing at the same extent. In fact, the graph's going the other way. It's a bumpy line, but it's heading down. So it does seem to suggest that these very strict measures, which are stopping people from moving around the country, are kind of kicking in and that it is working. I mean, in Beijing, for example, there are only a couple of hundred cases here, and yet very strict measures now in place. Like every housing compound, unless you live there, you can't go in. So in theory, you're not supposed to have a friend over to your house to have dinner or something like that. it's very strict. And on the streets now, you know, once I came out of quarantine, I'm wandering around having a bit of a look. There are no cars. There are hardly any people. Those who are outside, of course, have got face masks on. Most people, if they have a choice, won't leave home. And many companies have said simply to people to work from home, or they've introduced kind of staggered working arrangements. So not everybody crowds into the subway at the same time, or not everybody is on a public bus at the same time. And therefore, and thereby, you're restricting people's exposure to this potentially deadly virus.
But obviously, many people simply can't go to their workplace or work remotely. If you have thousands of people in any given city who are otherwise would be serving as, say, restaurant workers, and they're not doing that, is this taking a significant hit on the Chinese economy?
Yeah, well, imagine that it take an enormous hit. The Chinese economy is getting pounded by this. But I should add, with restaurants, they're kind of exempt. So food or some sort of other, like emergency services, electricity, water, this type of stuff, you're supposed to be still going to work to keep people nourished and alive, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, imagine every little small business that's struggling from week to survive, or some itinerant laborer who lives in a small town, has traveled to a big city to maybe work in a factory. The factory is not open. He doesn't have any pay. How does he pay his rent? You know, for the factory owner, how does he keep all that, the staff there, the factory, you know, operating without, being able to get supplies from another factory that isn't open? It's huge. It's enormous. And this is why people are really hoping that there is some sort of turning point coming. But I don't know. I think it could take many months, to tell the truth.
And Sean, you've been, I guess, taking note of incidents of xenophobia and racism happening to people who are either Chinese or simply appear Asian happening abroad, correct?
Yes. Actually, in taking the evacuation flight, many of the people on the flight said, we're nervous not just because we came from Wuhan and there's a stigma attached to that, but just because we are ethnically Chinese. And one woman said, you know, I'm afraid of my child being bullied at school, especially if anyone knows that he's been to Wuhan, but also just because he is ethnically Chinese. And that's a worry among a lot of people, I think, that I've spoken to, Americans heading back.
Yeah, and I mean, do we see governments abroad taking aggressive measures to kind of combat that sort of xenophobia, or are they really more scared about the spread of the disease?
I think at this point they're more scared about the spread and trying to contain it and instituting travel bans and other regulations like that.
How long should we expect the quarantines to last, Sean?
Well, at this point, in the U.S., they've evacuated all of the people from Hubei that I think are wanted to be evacuated. So, you know, the quarantine is 14 days unless you actually are infected, right? And then they might reconsider close contacts. So we're all going to be out of here within less than 2 weeks. In China, you know, who knows? The city where I was stuck, they told us that it could last for months, which is actually amazing considering to consider a big city like that.
Sean Li is a China-based correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Stephen McDonnell is a Beijing-based correspondent for the BBC. Thanks to you both for joining us. On this show, we've continued to cover allegations of physical and sexual abuse in federal immigration detention facilities. These facilities, run by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, have continually fallen under scrutiny for their secretive practices. But last month, the federal government moved forward with a plan, alarming journalists, migrant rights groups, and transparency advocates. The National Archives, the federal body in charge of preserving government records, agreed to let ICE officials delete or destroy records related to migrant deaths and abuse in their custody. This agreement has been in the works since 2017. But despite the widespread backlash to this plan, both from the public and lawmakers, they moved forward with the plan last month. Joining me now is Matthew Connolly, professor of history at Columbia University and the author of a recent op-ed in the New York Times, Why You May Never Learn the Truth About ICE. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
To begin, can you explain how the National Archives decides what records to keep?
Well, the National Archives has a difficult job in that they have to make predictions about what people are going to be interested in, not just now, but 50, 100 years from now. So they work with people in different departments and agencies, and they come up with what they call records retention schedules. And that's where they identify which are the records that they think historians, journalists, and others are going to be interested in down the road. And sometimes they decide in other cases, in most cases actually, that they're going to delete or destroy records. And they might do that within 3 years, 5, 10, sometimes 75 years.
So it's subjective.
It is to some extent subjective, but they've been doing this for a long time. The National Archives has been around, you know, since 1932. And so they've developed certain principles about what it is that they think is going to be historically significant.
In your New York Times op-ed, you focused on a certain body of information related to ICE records that is now likely to be destroyed. What can you tell us about these records and what they contain?
Yeah, so for example, I mean, there are many different examples you could give, but it includes the office within ICE that's responsible for receiving civil rights complaints. And that includes complaints about poor medical care. And as a lot of us know, this has been one of the most controversial issues that's accompanied the whole border crisis is the fact that many, many detainees have been denied decent medical care, leading to, in many cases, you know, illness or worse, leading to death. And these records surprised me, but in many cases, these were the kinds of records that they decided could be deleted, you know, not just 50 or 100 years from now. They decided these were records that could be deleted within 3 years.
Which begs the question, how independent is the National Archives, or rather, how likely are they to be under political pressure?
Well, I think the people at the National Archives would like to do the right thing. I mean, these are professionals. They've been doing this kind of work for many decades now. But the fact is, especially since, you know, the beginning of the Trump administration, they are under severe pressure. It's hard to know if they're getting political pressure or what kinds of pressure. There's a controversial case recently where the archivist of the United States decided to doctor a photo because that photo showed protest posters ridiculing Donald Trump. But I think even more important, what's really driving a lot of this is the fact that the National Archives has been starved of resources.
And so how does that, I guess, translate to what's happening right now here?
So just to give you an example, the National Archives is managing three times as many paper records as it was back in 1985, and it has a smaller workforce now than it did then. It has the same budget that it had back in 2008. That budget has been cut every year for the last 3 years. And when you think about it, the National Archives, you know, their job grows every year. It's relentless because, especially with the coming of electronic records and social media and so on, the amount of information they have to manage has been growing exponentially, and they're having to do it with fewer and fewer resources.
So you wrote about this in the New York Times, specifically calling on these documents to be protected. And after being more or less stonewalled, you actually received a response, or rather the Times received a response from the chief archivist of the United States. What did this this response say?
Well, David Ferriero, the archivist of the United States, said that what I had done was to paint a wholly misleading picture of what was happening at the National Archives. And in the even longer version that he published in the National Archives newsletter, he had more than 1,000 words of everything that was wrong with what I wrote. But I went through it one by one. And actually, what I was able to show was it's even worse than we thought. There were things in his denial that actually made news. For instance, for the first time, he admitted, you know, that the State Department was now using machine learning algorithms to identify automatically what records were going to be deleted or destroyed. This is completely unprecedented.
Why does it matter that it's an algorithm? What is it looking for to destroy?
Yeah, so it's not impossible that you could develop algorithms that would do this kind of work. In a way, it would be the same way that Netflix or Amazon uses algorithms to try to predict what movie you'd like to watch, what product you might want to buy. But, you know, Amazon has really good data scientists. And in fact, when they get it wrong, you know, the worst thing that could happen is they suggest some product that you don't want. So in this case, you know, the government, in this case, the State Department, is trying to use data science techniques in a way that has not publicly been discussed. There's no discussion or reporting on what the performance is of these algorithms. And the consequences when it gets things wrong is that it potentially, at least, millions of records are going to be automatically deleted, and then we're never going to hear anything more about it.
Now, tens of thousands of people commented about ICE deleting these records, and yet it's still moving forward. Is there any way in which this sort of action can be stopped?
I hope so. In this case, you know, for example, David Ferriero, the archivist of the United States, said that they had made a concession after getting this unprecedented opposition. They decided that instead of deleting the records having to do with the sexual assault of detainees, including thousands of minors, that they were going to preserve those records for 25 years instead of 20 years. So I'm a little bit worried that even after getting unprecedented opposition, including a lot of opposition in Congress, they make such a minor concession and call it a win. But what I'd like to see, what I'm hope more we'll see more of going forward, is that more people are going to begin to speak up, including more congressmen and senators, that we might finally have a hearing where the National Archives is asked to account for these kinds of choices. David Ferriero, the Archivist of the United States, hasn't been on Capitol Hill for 5 years. The last time he was invited to appear and answer questions, it was about why it is the National Archives is the worst place, one of the worst places to work in the federal government.
Matthew Connolly is a professor of history at Columbia University. Matthew, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Filmmaker Kathy Yan didn't take the most direct route to get to Hollywood. Before making movies herself, Kathy was a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
I started in New York, and I actually covered arts and entertainment. Then I moved to Hong Kong, and I helped them start a very brief moment where we had a Hong Kong section of the Asian Wall Street Journal, and I covered Hong Kong, and I went into mainland China as well.
Eventually, Kathy went back to school, getting dual graduate degrees in business and filmmaking at NYU. Her first movie, the dark comedy Dead Pigs, premiered at Sundance in 2018. Now she's out with her second feature, and it's on a much bigger scale. Birds of Prey is the latest superhero film set in the DC universe. And while it takes place in Gotham City, Batman and the Joker are nowhere to be found. Instead, Kathy's movie centers around supervillain Harley Quinn, played by Margot Robbie, who's forced to team up with a group of female outcasts to take on a vicious crime boss.
Do you know what that means? That means he's not just after the kid anymore. He's after all of us. Sure as hell after me. I just robbed him. You just betrayed him, you just killed his BFF, and you're dumb enough to be building a case against him. So, unless we all want to die very unpleasant deaths, we're going to have to work together.
When I spoke with Kathy, she began by telling me how she made the jump from indies to the big-budget superhero world.
I think that you see them taking chances on plenty of men that haven't had world. So, I'm very happy that they took a chance on me, but I think that, you know, the movie is about the feminine experience, the female experience in many ways. And so I think I was able to relate to it in a very personal way. And on top of that, I think it was just, I think it was luck and good timing. I think what I was able to show in my first feature actually was oddly very, very similar to what they needed, I think, from a director on Birds. My first feature, Dead Pigs, was also an ensemble film. It also had a very dark comedy to it. And that kind of just miraculously worked out that way. So it sounds very crazy, but I guess it kind of made sense.
Typically, you haven't seen nearly as many female antiheroes as male antiheroes, who are pretty much everywhere in pop culture. What was it that appealed to you about this character of Harley Quinn?
Partially because she's an antihero. I think it's really nice to see a female character that can inhabit all those things. I mean, that's what makes Harley, I think, so compelling. She is both, you know, a sort of manic pixie girl with a lot of childlike wonder, but at the same time, she's capable of so much violence. And she's not necessarily a good person. She is just, I think, a raw person. And she's still trying to figure herself out. She's capable of making a ton of mistakes and doing the wrong thing as much as she's capable of doing the right thing sometimes. So I just found her incredibly relatable in that way. And, you know, I think we just got a glimpse of her in Suicide Squad and the ability to really dive into who she is and also see more vulnerable sides of her. It was really compelling and interesting to me.
I mean, obviously, a film like this is for a very broad audience. But, you know, when we look at action films over the years, you know, we were told in so many ways that, you know, American boys like to watch action violence and American girls not so much. And I'm just wondering, you know, has all of that been thrown out the window now?
Gosh, I hope so. And frankly, I think it's always been like that. I think that, you know, I grew up with a nice diet of action films from the 80s and 90s. I've always loved them. And I've always loved, you know, especially like the Batman movies. back in the day as well. And the idea that women did not enjoy watching these movies is a little bit ridiculous. And I think that also the idea that like women would not ever want to direct an action movie is also proven to be false. And so, yeah, I mean, I think just for a long time, there was an expectation that women would watch male-driven and male-led action movies. And we've just been a part of that. And that's just what we've enjoyed, but also what was expected. And so hopefully we can kind of flip that around a little bit, too.
In terms of style, DC movies tend to be darker than, say, Marvel movies. Your movie's colorful, has a lot of humor. Were you setting out to make it look different than some of the movies that are set in Gotham City that came out before this?
Yes, definitely. I think that all of it was inspired by Harley's perspective and point of view, and she is so funny. She's innately a very, very funny character. And so that was also part, that was always a part of it. And I really wanted to create a Gotham that still had a little bit of hope and wasn't so dreary, wasn't so bleak. Obviously, it's a broken system. It doesn't really work very well, and it's, you know, run by these crazy villains and you know, these kind of criminal empires. But at the same time, I think that people just kind of live on and have, you know, and have their lives, and, you know, they're going to find these moments of levity and hope. And that was the Gotham that I sort of wanted to create. And actually, if you go back even further, if you look at like the Joel Schumacher, you know, Batman's, that was a very, very colorful and campy version of Gotham, too. So I think we're just used to a certain type of Gotham for some time now, but it hasn't always been like that. And I was, you know, I think that, again, it was just the idea that, like, it could be more than just, like, a bleak version of the future or a dystopian version of what we're used to. And I think, especially given where we are right now, a nice dose of hope and humor is always welcome.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm so curious about, that, because when you're making a film like this, it takes time to write it, to pre-produce and then produce it, and finally for it to be released. But are you very consciously sort of like thinking about the time in which we live when you're, you know, putting something out like this into the world?
Oh, absolutely. I think that goes back to my journalism roots as well. In my mind, there really isn't that much of a difference. There's a journalistic, I think, angle to everything that I do. And it is very ironic in a way that Margot pitched this movie almost 5 years ago. And this was before, this is before a lot of things happened, let's
like
say.
What? Like what?
Well, I think before me, you know, exactly. It's like before a lot of things, but before the world changed.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think that's, it's pretty remarkable impression on her part to want this. And I think similarly, a lot of women have probably wanted to see something like this on screen, and maybe they weren't able to fully articulate it. And so it's been really nice to see that conversation. But the way I look at movies is exactly that. Like, why is it getting made now? Why do I want to do it? Why do I want to direct this? Why do I want to devote a year and a half of my life at least to this project? And for me, it's always have, it always has to have some sort of compelling conversation with the world at large.
Are there particular films or texts or objects that you're drawing from, like, you know, when you're creating sort of like, I mean, the lookbook, if you will, when you're when you're making this film?
Oh, yeah. We had so much fun with that. Of course, we were somewhat inspired by the comics as well, you know, and in some ways, I think that like the sort of tactile 2D quality of it, how practical it is, the colorfulness of it, that was inspired directly by the comics. And then on top of that, we had so many different references. Aesthetically, we also looked at A Clockwork Orange because of just like the heightened world that it was, the way that Kubrick treated the gangs, and also even just like the milk bar and his use of the female form, which we sort of pulled from too in both The Black Mass Club as well as The Booby Trap, hence The Booby Trap. we, you know, we looked at a lot of, you know, movies set in sort of New York in the 70s and 80s as well, a lot of Scorsese films, the way that it feels almost like a neighborhood, looking at something like Raging Bull in that way, because a lot of this movie is actually very intimate. You know, Birds of Prey, it's really not about saving the universe or the world. It's about saving a young girl. Mm. And these characters kind of run into each other all the time. And most of the movie happens over the course of a day. And so if you add all that up, you realize that, like, we're really talking about a neighborhood movie. And I really liked that. I felt like there was a real intimacy there that we haven't seen in a lot of these types of movies before. And so referencing that and making it loud and brash, and if you're in an apartment, maybe being able to overhear your neighbors, you know, because the walls are so thin, or you can hear the traffic. And that was all part of it, too, to just kind of create this, like, loud, crazy, vibrant world.
You got some important advice from another woman director at a key moment when you're making this, from Wonder Woman's Patty Jenkins. What did she mm-hmm. tell you?
Well, she just said to, you know, she reminded me, basically, what a director does. And to lean into that, I mean, she basically said, you know, you're the director and you know this movie better than anyone. That is why you're here. That's the role that you were given. And you need to be confident in that. And I know it sounds very obvious in a way, but sometimes you just need that little gentle reminder.
I mean, presumably this is at one of the many very tough moments of making the movie.
Well, I think that there are so many different roles that a film has, and a director is actually, it's very nebulous in a way. Like, it's hard to have a direct definition of what directing is and what it can do. And I think a lot of people might think that what we do most is just talk to actors. Well, that's actually one small element of what we do. And there's also a huge element of just managing people and creating a nice team in front of camera and off camera, and, you know, trying to oversee every creative decision, everything that fills the frame, everything that you can hear and everything that you can see. And because you're having these conversations and you're the only person that's having all of these conversations, you innately become the director and you become the person that knows the movie the best, or the version of the movie that you want to make. And sometimes you kind of forget that, you know, you forget where you are in that entire, like, system.
I mean, a movie like this is just so huge, right? I mean, do you even know how many people worked on this movie?
I don't know the exact number, which is a little bit terrifying. But yeah, I mean, we would fluctuate for sure. You know, there are days where we had 200, 300 extras, I think. And I think on average, we probably had at least 150, 200 crew members.
I mean, but it's just like, even people who are not on set, like
the
amount of time credits take to roll past when you sit and watch the credits, you know, like there are thousands of people, it seems, who work on these things. I mean, but when you look at your career and where you hope it's going to go, do you imagine that you could stick with big budget films, or is there something about smaller films that you just want to be able to go back and forth with?
I would love to go back and forth. I think that's what's so interesting now. I'm going back to do a very small, intimate film with A24, hopefully after this. And for me, it's less about the scale or size of a movie. I just constantly want to be challenged, and I want to be able to tell the stories that are most interesting to me. I'm very drawn to complicated female characters. That's been something that I'm always kind of looking at. And then whatever scale that seems to fit, you know, to fit that. And even with this movie, for me, it was less like, ooh, I get to make a big studio movie, and more like, I actually really love this script. I think it's interesting and compelling, and I love the spirit of it and the attitude, and I love what it's trying to say.
Having seen the industry from the outside and then being where you are now, what do you think has changed most significantly in terms of making movies in Hollywood?
That's a good question. I think a lot has changed, and yet a lot has not. I think that there is definitely an awareness now to bring in new voices, and there's almost a pressure to do so because there are those that are leading by example in a way. And I do give a lot of credit to Warner Brothers for even giving me an opportunity as this one. And clearly this is a great year, and hopefully a watershed year for female directors directing these kinds of big comic book movies. So I think the opportunity is definitely growing, but I think there's still a lot more work to be done. And I think there's a lot more conversations to be had about how to make this a sustainable thing and to really trust and believe in female creative talent in a way that I don't think the industry has really had to reckon with before.
Margot Robbie stars in the film, but she also produced it, as you mentioned earlier. How much of a role did she play in making sure that women made up the main creative team?
Yeah, she definitely did. And, you know, she's done so much in her career to support that. I think she's made it quite clear, though, that, you know, the best person gets the job. And that's something that we really took as well when we were looking at our creative team and expanding that in terms of our HODs. We weren't like demanding of it. It was more like we made an outsized effort to make sure that women were a part of that conversation, were coming in. But at the end of the day, the best person gets the job. And so we had a very, very diverse crew members as well and team behind the camera, but I wouldn't say it was all women. And I think in a way that I think is the healthy approach to it all, because I know as someone that was hired like this, I would love to think that I wasn't just hired because of my gender either.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in that sense, how do you still feel the old guard in the presence of I guess, conventional thinking in the industry?
Sure. I just think it's such a large industry, and it just takes a little while, I think, to have these changes. And so the growing pains are such that sometimes there is this element of, well, let's just go for the most simplistic version of something. And so like, okay, let's hire more women, or let's hire more people of color, or whatever it is. And that's great that the want and desire is there for whatever is actually motivating them. But I think that as more of these voices are going in, we can kind of change within the system and say it's not enough just to hire people of color based off of their color or hire women based off of their gender, but like, what can we do to really keep that keep it sustainable and to support them in every other way? And, you know, I look at, for example, the fact that when I went to film school at NYU, more than half of my class were women, and yet it's still so hard to be a female director. So what can we do about that? You know, what are the systems in place? What are the gatekeepers to really allow that to flourish more? And let's not like stop and pat ourselves on the back quite yet.
Kathy Yan is the director of Birds of Prey. Thanks so much, Kathy.
Cool. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Remember, you can always call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.